All right, welcome to class today. Glad to see you all here. Let's begin by talking about last week's in-class quiz. On the whole, we did pretty well on this quiz. Much better on page one than page two. Generally doing all right. We'll actually talk a little bit about some things as we move forward here, but in general, you were pretty good at figuring out how these things worked. There were multiple solutions to a few of them. For example, nothing is G could mean everything is not G, or there does not exist a G. There are several of those kinds of variations you could tweak around with. But we had, that was pretty good. We were doing a little less good when it got time to do page two. And partly that's because the logic got more complicated, partly because there's some extra steps here. We are pretty good at no monkeys and alligator. Just a few of you had a little trouble with that. Slick loves every alligator that loves Howler. We started seeing some and versus implication problems in particular. And then every animal in the zoo has an animal that they love that loves them back. That one tripped up a lot of people. So you have some individual feedback on your quizzes. If you go to the progress site, you can see how you did. I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about this beyond what's on the key. Note that the key is just one way of solving each of them. I don't have multiple solutions for any of them except the one. But notably here on number six, we didn't care whether you added clauses that says the two animals have to be different. That didn't matter to us. Some of you were very creative in what you did, and we may have misunderstood things, so if you think you should have gotten more points than you did, let us know. But in general, right, we have to have, the animal has to be at the zoo, so we have to have the zoo implies the other pieces. We have the reciprocal love. Most of us did pretty well with reciprocal love. And then we have to have the quantifiers in the order they appear in the sentence. Every animal in the zoo, for all animals, has an animal, there exists an animal. And so that was important there. There was a fair amount of like moving around the three terms in number five as well. And there are multiple ways we could do this. There's actually a way where we say something implies another implication that would also work here. But it's important to note here that the result is that Slick loves something. Slick loves what? Slick loves him only if they're an alligator and if they love Howler. So both of those things are antecedents. Questions about the quiz? Yes?
So mine says awaiting feedback. Is it coming?
Oh.
Yeah.
That probably means I forgot to press his magic button in my office. You'll get to find out how you did after class. Sorry. I should have done that yesterday. I had all the grades ready by noon. I just didn't push the button. My fault. I apologize for that. So, you'll get to see how you did soon. Sorry. Other questions? Not yet knowing how you did? Okay, we may take a moment again on this another day. Anything else you have thoughts, comments, questions before we dive back into how we are at groups? Okay. So we're just going to, the plan today, we talked about the principles we're going to use last time. My plan today is we're just going to walk through several kinds of activities, and we'll end up by looking at what the practice quiz we have for Friday is. I may add some, here are some bookwork things to the practice quiz that aren't currently there, but it's basically prep. So let's start with this statement. Prove that for all x there exists a y such that c of x and l of xy entails for all x c of x. This is the thing we're supposed to prove. When asked to prove something, what is the first thing we should do? Check to see if it's true. Try a few examples or counterexamples. Okay? So take a moment, turn to who you're sitting next to, see if you can figure out. I haven't even told you what C and L mean, so make it up or however you want to do it, but see if you can convince yourself either true or false before we continue. counterexample. Okay. That might mean that we think it's true. It might mean we don't know how to make counterexamples. Maybe we have questions before we try to proceed with the proof about how we go about example, counterexample, and the like. Yes?
What distinguishes endowments from implies?
What's your saying? Entail and imply? This is a great question. Imply is part of an expression. An implication can be part of something that can be either true or false. By entailment, we mean the implication is true. We are asserting a fact that if you replaced it with an implication, you would result in a tautology. Something is true no matter what else happens. So by saying the first one entails the second one, I am saying that the first one logically always implies the second one regardless of the meaning of its pieces. If I just said implies here instead, I would be saying something that might be true or might be false. I'd be talking about a claim instead of a universal truth. Does that help at all? It is related to the notion we have between an equivalence and a by implication. I can talk about two things by implying each other, and I might be right, I might be wrong. If I say they're equivalent, I mean I'm right when I say they by imply each other. It's the same thing here, but in one direction. Any follow-ups to that or other questions? Let me actually just take that a little bit further. That means, in particular, that I could take this like this, turn this into an implication, and then what I'm trying to do is prove that this is true. Okay, so the whole idea of, I guess I need more brackets here. The entailment means the implication is true. So I'm trying to prove that this is a true statement. Yes?
It means it's always true.
Like always true, regardless of the meaning of all of my letters. Yep. True by logical definition, not my instance. Other questions? Okay, how can we go about proving this? We have seen a handful of techniques for proving. Let's just remind ourselves of the various pieces we have. We have direct proof, where we use proof rules. Okay, we had equivalence and entailment. We had both forms, but they're both sort of this direct proof. We can also prove entailment by assume the antecedent, assume the left-hand side, let's say. And then prove the right-hand side. Okay, so this is an approach we're always allowed to use with entailment. We just assume the thing on the left and see if we can prove the thing on the right. This is also a form of direct proof, typically. But we can do this as well. We also have for all. So for all, we can instantiate with an unknown variable. So we could take that for all x and say, I'm going to remove the for all x and just say, I don't know what x means. And I have to use a different x on each side. Each of the for alls have to get their own one. Okay? And I have an exists. I can instantiate with a value of my choice. And we have all of these pieces in this expression. We have for alls, we have exists, we have entailments, we have logic. We can pick and choose between these techniques. They're all available to us. And we have cases. We can say, we can introduce some sort of disjunction. Okay, and then we can assume each side on its own. So we could just say there's something we know is a disjunctive tautology, something is one or the other has to be true, and then proceed from there. And so we have all of these techniques at our disposal. We could try using any of them. Some of them will be easier than others. I'm happy to start wherever you would like. Does anybody have strong feelings about which recruiting technique they'd like to see?
Can we do entailments?
Sure, let's do entailments. All right, so proof of entailment, the proof is going to look like this. I'm going to assume this. I'm just going to say, poof, I know it. Because an entailment only has to be true if the thing on the left was true, so I'm just going to assume the thing was on the left was true and see if I can prove the thing on the right. Okay, and I need to use proof rules or one of the other techniques to do that. So I'm just going to assume this. Let's see how close I can get it to the form I want. I'm trying to prove for all x, c of x. So I'm going to see how close I can get it. So I am going to start without being full pros, and then we'll get to pros later. So I have this to start with. And then let's see if I can rewrite this in a cleaner way, a closer way. First thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to take the exists and move it over here. Am I allowed to do that? I want to do that because it gets my for all x, c of x by itself. Am I allowed to do that? How do I know when I'm allowed to move quantifiers? Yeah?
If they don't cross their own variables, they don't cross
their quantifiers? Correct. They can cross anything other than their own variables, so they can't cross this, and they can't cross other quantifiers, but they can cross expressions that don't use their variable and don't include quantifiers. So I'm welcome to slide this back and forth across the C of X, because Y is not involved in C of X, and we don't introduce a new variable in C of X. Okay? Now, we have just sort of been using this. I don't really have parentheses here, but it's worth noting that I do really have parentheses. A quantifier applies to everything to its right. My expression is not for all x, c of x, and there exists something. It's for all x, this and. Okay? So I can't just say, I have an and, and half of it's what I'm trying to prove, I'm done. Because I don't quite have that circumstance. If I add in the parentheses where they belong. And so I have this scenario where I have, for all x, two things are true. C of x is true and exists y, L of x, y is true. For every x I can pick. Where can I go from here? Yeah?
Do we have something that says, if an and statement is true, then both individual parts?
We do, but I don't yet have an and statement. I have a for all statement that contains an and statement. So you're right, if the parentheses were different, if the parentheses around this first part, then I would be done. Because if an and is true, both halves of it have to be true. But I don't have parentheses around that part. I've got an opening parenthesis without a matching close in that part, so I can't just split it up yet. Yeah?
Are you allowed to distribute the for all?
Can I distribute the for all? We haven't actually talked about the answer, though we have talked about the tools we would need to know the answer. Chat with whoever you're sitting next to. Do you think I can distribute the for all? Is it legal for me to put a for all in the CX and a different for all for the exists Y? Decide with your neighbor what you think is true. Things. Thumbs up if you think it's okay, thumbs down if you don't. What do we think? Yes, it's okay. No, it isn't. And the answer is yes, it's okay. Let's explain why. Okay? For all. What does a for all mean? A for all is a whole bunch of ands. It's an and over the whole domain. An exists is an or over the whole domain. That's the definition of an and, a for all and an exists. And for all means it, for every single thing in the domain and them all together, and just means for every single thing in the domain or them all together. Therefore, for alls distribute over and. Because ands are associative and commutative. And so I am allowed to take a for all and distribute it over an and. Because the for all is an and the and is an and plays nicely with and. So this is a legal move. I am allowed to do that, except I have the wrong number of parentheses. If I had an or, I would not be allowed to do that. Because ors and ands don't play nicely with each other. But ands and ands play nicely with each other, and for alls are a whole bunch of ands. Questions? Yeah?
So you're saying, would you be able to do this for, like, for each over an or statement?
Yeah, if I had there an exists and an or, I would also be able to do the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah? Other questions? Yeah? I'm sorry, say it louder. Explain where... Oh, I don't know. That's a typo, I think. Where are my negative y's? I think I just accidentally bumped the negative sign at some point. Sorry. Other questions? Yeah?
If that was an or in the middle, would we still be able to distribute the
ands? Nope. For alls go over ands, not ors. Exists go over ors, not ands. Okay. Now that I have this, I have a rule. If I know two things are true, I know each of them is true. So because I know this, I can derive actually both sides of it individually. Okay? If you know a conjunction, you know both parts of the conjunction. And so I know both of those. One of those is the thing I cared about. And so I have now successfully assumed the left-hand side, proven the right-hand side. I also proved other stuff, but meh, doesn't really matter. Okay, I proved the thing I was trying to prove, and therefore I have proved the entailment. Questions about the proof technique we used, how we got here? Yeah?
Not quite like
sorry, I meant the person behind you. I'll get to you just a moment. That's right, sorry. You didn't know which one I meant, I just looked in your direction. Yes? How did I get from the first line to the second line? They're the same line? You mean from this line to this line? From this line?
Yeah.
To this line?
Yes.
All right, I moved the exists. A quantifier can move over expressions that do not include their variable and are not other quantifiers. Yes?
Yeah, I'm just kind of confused as to like how this constitutes proving the entailment.
How is it constituted? I assumed the left-hand side and I proved the right-hand side.
Wait, what do you assume?
I just assumed it was true, and if it was true, I proved the other thing was true. Which is what entailment means. Right? Entailment means every time this is true, this is also true. And so I said, let's assume it is true. Ta-da! The other one was true. We'll try to turn this into prose here next. Turn it into actual texts. See if we can clean it up. But before I do that, any other questions? Okay, this is not... Oh, I see somebody pointing at somebody. Oh, yes, sorry.
Can we use any of the other methods to prove the same thing
successfully? We can, yes. Maybe we will. Let's finish turning this into text and we'll come back and do another one. Okay? All right. So, let me try to write this up. When we want to present a proof, we want to present a proof in prose, in text, in English, if we're speaking English, to other people so that they will believe that we have proven something is true. Okay? And so, the structure would look like this. We would say proof. We would put this all in a serif font with italics and so on. I'm not going to bother with that. Okay, so the proof. I want to describe the steps I did here in English. So I'm going to say assume, and I'm going to say exactly the thing I assume. So assume this. And now I want to describe how I get to the end result. So I can say something like, we can move the, across a term to get, and then we have this. So I describe what I did here. I say what I did was I moved a term, okay? I moved the exists across a term in my expression. Note here, I'm being a little loose with terminology. Phrases like term and so on do have formal definitions. I'm not going to get into those a whole lot here. If you want to say a clause or a part or a predicate or whatever you want to say, we're good for this class. Okay? Move the exists across a term to get this thing. We then distribute the for all to get, and let's pick this one because I think that one was reasonably clear. Which is a conjunction and thus entails its conjuncts, including this. Okay, and again, you don't need to use the word conjunct. You can say its parts, its terms, whatever you want to say as you're going along here. You should have balanced parentheses though. Okay, that's all of the logic. And now I need to point out that I have finished the proof. I can say, because assuming this, let us prove this. It must be that the thing we're trying to prove. Ah, too far. Yes?
Can you please balance your parentheses?
Do I have to? All right. Yes?
So typically in scientific writing, you avoid using first person, but is that
okay here? Yeah, so it turns out that different disciplines have different rules about first person. And computer science really likes first person. Computer science texts will almost always be written in first person, usually first person plural, even if there's only one author. If you want to use second person or third person, no, second person would be a little weird. If you want to use third person, you can get away with it. Part of this has to do with the fact that often the way we avoid first person disciplines is by using the passive voice, and the passive voice tends to allow clauses to be stated as if they were true, but we don't know why. There actually is a rationale behind it that we will generally use first person in proofs and all texts in computing. Yes?
How are you doing all this without knowing what C and L are?
Yeah, how did I do without knowing what C and L are? I just never paid attention to what they were. I just used the meaning of logic without caring what the predicates were. Now, it won't work in every case. For this particular proof, it is entailed entirely by logic, not by the definition of the predicates included. Okay? So I have said it's, I don't care what C and L are, I've implicitly said for all C and all L, this is true. Because I've never told you what they are. And so I've just proved it in its logical form instead of in its definitional form. Other questions? Okay, this is certainly not the only final proof you could end up with. There are lots of final texts you could include. But it does give you some idea of what we want to do. We want to hit the high points of our process. We don't need every single step, but we don't want to skip a step that a human will have difficulty getting. And we want enough text in between that humans will know what we're doing. And when I say humans, I mean your fellow students. Okay? So you need to know your audience to write persuasively. This is a form of persuasive writing. We are trying to persuade our audience that we know this is true and so should they. Any questions about this before we try another approach? Yes?
It's okay to kind of use not CAD, like informal language with that sort of thing? Like, or because you're saying there's a specific definition.
Yeah, so if I was writing this to logicians, I would make absolutely certain that when I said term and conjunct and entails, and I got those words exactly right. But since I'm writing to students and to computer scientists, if you said term and you meant expression, they're going to say, yeah, yeah, I know what you meant. So I don't care as much about the terminology for the audience I am training you to talk to. Yes?
So at the very end of the proof where we have the for all x of c of x and then we have the for all x of there exists y, or is it L of x?
Uh-huh.
L of x, y. So because we proved the first part, we can, and we're looking for that first part, we can just automatically kind of disregard that second part.
Yeah, I happened to prove something else along the way, but who cares? Wasn't my goal. Other questions? Okay. I'm happy to take one more proof technique, and then we'll move on to some other theorems and see if we can prove them as well. What one other proof technique would like to see? Yes. We have a vote for cases. Okay. How would I go about doing proof by cases when I don't even know what my predicates mean? Ah! How can I do this? Well, there are several things I could do. Essentially, I'm going to pick a larger subclause to decide if I think it's true or false. Okay. So case is a little tricky with the quantifiers, but it can still be done. So let's see what we can do with cases. The first thing I need to do is state the disjunctive tautology. I need to decide what the thing is that I have. It's one or the other. Okay? And so I could pick lots of different disjunctive tautologies, but usually I pick something or its negation. Okay? And so I could, but basically my choices here are c of x or L of xy. Those are the sorts of things I could do, and I could keep the quantifiers or not, depending on my preference. So I can sort of pick a subpart of this to decide if I think it's true. Let's take, how about we do this? Let's go in, I can say either this or the not of it. Here's going to be my disjunctive tautology. Do we agree that this is a disjunctive tautology? That one or the other has to be true? Okay? Then what I can do is I can proceed by cases. So I can say case one, this. Now I have this assumption I can use for this case. I can assume that for all x, c of x. And if I assume that for all x is c of x, I can say in this case, and I can just decide what this means. Is equivalent to, and in this case, I know this side is just true. I don't remember how to write the top symbol. True. We'll just write it true. Okay? Because I've just assumed that's my case. And on this side, I also have a true. Why is it okay to turn my c of x just into true over there? Yeah?
Because you're assuming in case one for all x, c of x.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's true for every x, so clearly it's true for whatever one was there. Right, that's my case assumption. Now, is this entailment true? Actually, didn't need that second half. Because anything that entails true is true. Right? So I can say, because anything entails true, the entailment holds in this case. So I do a case. And then I can do the other case. Case two. That needs to be the other half of my disjunction. I can't pick arbitrarily. I pick the other half of my disjunction. And then I say, in this case, and I'm going to do the same thing. Again, I'm going to want to try. I'm writing my prose here directly. I want to try to keep as similar structure as I can. So I'm just going to copy down directly, change the structure as little as I can. Except over here I have false. And over here I have, well, I don't know what I have. All I know is it is not always true. I don't know if this particular one is true or false inside of its quantified. But I know the right-hand side is false. Now I'm not done. No! For something to entail false, the something has to be false. So I now need to verify that this thing is false in order for my entailment to be true in this case. There are several ways I could get there. Yeah?
Why can't you just say that for all x, see if I can go to sign that that's false?
Because I don't have, they aren't together. Well, this one, I knew that no matter what x was, c of x was true. So I had a c of x, I could turn it to true. Here, I only know that sometimes c of x is false. I don't know if this particular x inside this expression was a false one or not. Okay, so what I can do here is I can do the same basic things we did before. I could also do more cases if I wanted. But I can distribute, I can, or move, I can distribute, and then I can turn this into false over here. And then since false is, and something is just false, that turns into this. Okay. And then I can say, because false does entail false, the entailment holds in this case. There are better ways to do this, probably. And I don't have to just do logic here. I don't have to do direct proof. I can do another proof by cases, pick another term to try things with, however I want it to work. But this will work here. And so I can go here, I can say the entailment holds in this case, and then I need my conclusion. Remember, an entailment, proof by cases needs three parts. State the disjunction, run my cases, and then state, because the entailment held in both cases, it must hold in general. I need to state that it always holds because it held in my cases. Whew. Let's zoom out and see if I can get the whole thing on the board at once. Questions about this proof? Yeah?
So, is the entailment true when both sides are the same?
The entailment is true if both sides are the same, or if the left-hand side is false and the right-hand side is true. False entails everything, everything entails true. So it's only true entails false that is not a correct statement. Other questions? Okay. Yes?
Do you have to prove both cases for it to hold it to be true?
Yes. If you do a case analysis, every case must prove the same thing. So that at the end, you can say all of the cases prove the same thing, so that thing is true. Yes?
The same thing being true equals true, false equals false, just sort of left and right.
It doesn't matter what the conclusion is at the end, they just all have to have the same conclusion for you to be able to draw it in general.
Okay.
Let's look at a very different, we'll skip that one. Let's look at this one. Here's a function written in some sort of pseudocode that I hope you'll all recognize. Function sine of x. If x is less than 0, it returns negative 1. If it's equal to 0, it returns 0. If it's greater than 0, it returns 1. Otherwise, it crashes. And my theorem is this function never crashes. Okay? First, again, anytime you're given something to prove, try some examples, see if you agree. Can you come up with a counterexample? Take a moment, turn your using next to you, see if you agree with this theorem. Question?
Why is it crashing, but they are doing it
I mean, yes, this line here is causing it to crash.
Okay.
Yep. Example. Yes.
If you have a string.
If you have a string, what will happen? Error. How about if I know that I have a number? Let's assume the domain of X is numbers. Now do we have a counterexample? An imaginary number. Oh, okay. Let's suppose the domain of X is the floating point data type in your programming language. Double or float, yes. Yes, it depends on what language this is in. Right, I've just written the idea of the algorithm rather than the details. So there might be some case where it wouldn't compile. Depends on the language. Yeah?
Are there numbers that might be out of bounds?
Are there numbers that are out of bounds? It turns out, yes, actually, in real code, actually, probably every programming language you've ever used has a special floating point number that's name is not a number and will cause this to crash with an error. Anyway, we're going to ignore all that. Let's just say we're doing the integer data types. This will work for the integer data types in every programming language I've ever used. Okay, so we'll assume there's an integer coming in. Okay, so this is not, code is complicated because there's so many weird corner cases. But let's assume we have an integer. Now this becomes a true statement. It will not crash if we give it an integer. How do I prove this? Yes. I could do proof by cases, maybe. I don't know that yet because it's not yet logic. It is tempting to look at this and say, I'm going to jump directly into proof, but I'm going to strongly encourage you always turn your theorem into logic first. Okay? Turn it into predicates and so forth before you begin. Otherwise, you're going to end up sort of using one definition of something somewhere and a different definition somewhere else and ending up with an invalid proof. So how do I turn this into logic? Yeah?
Give each case like a P of X or whatever.
Give each case a P of X? Yeah, so I give a different predicate for each of the cases. But if I do that, I don't have any logic to connect my different predicates. So I'm going to keep some of the information I have. Why do we believe this works? It's because of something about the relationship of X and 0. So we need to keep the relationship of x and 0 in my formalism somehow. Okay? So I would suggest, if you remember back, I believe it was our very first in-class quiz, we showed you some code and asked you to do something with it. Now we had Booleans in that rather than less thans or equals. Okay? But if we were to try to turn this into logic, this case is the case x is less than 0. What is this case? X is equal to 0, and it's not the case that X is less than 0. This is an important thing about how return behaves in programming. If it hits the first one, it doesn't go on to the next one. Right? And so this one is X is greater than 0, and X is not equal to 0. And it is not the case that x is less than 0. Okay, let me use better symbols there. Nope, wrong one. No, that's the right one. All right. So I have this logic. And so what is the logic that needs to go in the last spot? In order to get to that last spot, I have to be in the case where none of the other ones happened. So I need to be in the case here. So the only time this should crash is an error, assuming that's the only line that crashes with an error, and we can always do our comparisons, I need this thing to be true. And so what this is really saying is, there does not exist an x such that this. This is the math of my theorem. Questions about my translation before we try a proof? Yes?
Do we need a bracket over everything for the last one? Like, after the...
Well, the line I currently have the cursor on?
Yeah.
Do I need a bracket? So, yeah, I guess if we want to try to be very explicit about my operator precedence, these nots are being applied to these individual operators. And I need to pick an operator precedent for and. Doesn't really matter what I pick because it's associative. Does this answer your question? Yes?
When you're doing this in like a quiz or something, could you use this format where it should be expected to make like propositions, like saying, I don't know, P of...
Unless we tell you which math techniques to use, you're welcome to use what you want, as long as you end up with something logical.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you're allowed to use numbers?
Yeah, so we'll get more into numbers next week, but in general, the numbers here are actually being used in predicates. Less than is a predicate. Greater than is a predicate. It takes two arguments, two numbers, and returns true or false. Okay, and so I could define, if I wanted to, I could have my greater than xy is defined to mean that x is greater than y. And you have my equal xy that is defined to mean that x is equal to y. And I could have my less than xy defined to mean that x is less than y. And then I could rewrite all of this using those instead. And I'm welcome to do that, but this sort of infix notation of predicates is generally considered good enough. Okay, so I can either define my predicates as letters here, or I can leave them in my operator format. Either one's okay. Other questions? Yes?
I'm confused about why there's like a not sign between x is greater than 0 but not x equals 0. But then with the letters, then there is not e.
Because I used a not equals instead of an equals here? Right.
So when you have the crash with an error, then the not only applies to the first term.
No, the not applies to all terms above it. How do I get here? I have to not get here and not get here and not get here.
Okay. So
not get here and not get here and not get here.
So why are the parentheses like surrounding just the x is greater than 0 on the first line?
Because that's the only one I've checked on this line.
I meant the first line under.
This one?
Yeah.
Because I'm saying it's not greater than 0. And it's not equal to 0. And it's not less than 0. Other questions? Whew. All right. Now I finally have a does not exist I need to prove. How do I prove does not exist? Yeah.
Do you prove for all x not the thing?
Yeah, so I could turn this into a for all and then use my for all rules. So this turns into for all x, it is not the case that all of that. And then how do I prove for alls? The simplest way to prove for all is just ignore the for all and make the proof without ever telling you what x is. Okay, now, we haven't talked about arithmetic in this class. I'm assuming you know it. So your proof would look like something like, there is no number. Every number is either greater than, equal to, or less than zero. Done. Okay, your actual proof won't be particularly complicated for this. You're just going to appeal to math. Appeal to arithmetic that people have already learned. Say everything has to be one of these three. It can't be not all of them. Making that formal is fairly complicated, and we won't get into that level of number theory in this course. Probably not in your time in CS, unless you decide to take a number theory class. There is ways of proving that you can't have all three of these be false at the same time, but in general, I would expect the proof to be something quite simple that says, every number is either less than, equal, or greater than zero, so you have to have returned in one of those three spots. Which is likely where you would have started if I hadn't told you to formalize it first. And you probably would have got it right because it's a simple example. I wanted to point out, though, that this process of creating the symbols is an important step. And hopefully, when you're done, you'll end up with something that you believe. Essentially, I'm going to say, via math, via arithmetic, let's say. Is it matic or metic? I never remember. It's an E? Metic. All right. Via arithmetic, at least one of GX0, EX0, and LX0 must be true. In fact, it's not just at least, it's exactly. This is a thing we know about the definition of greater than, equal, and less. Right? And that is sort of the extra piece that allows me to say it can't all of them not be the case. This actually turns into a disjunctive syllogism, or disjunctive tautology, which very naturally turns into a proof by cases. We could take the case where it's greater, the case where it's equal, the case where it's less, and be done. There's other ways of working here as well. Thoughts, comments, questions? All right, 2 minutes left. Let's do this one. I think this one will actually work quickly enough. We can do that. This is a weird one. I just made up this definition for the purpose of this class. This is not a standard mathematical definition. An addition-safe number is a positive number made up of n copies of the nth digit, where repeated summing of the digits yields n. So for example, 1 is addition-safe because it's 1 digit and it sums to 1. 2 is not, because although it's 2 2's, they sum to 4. 4 is not, because 4 4's sums to 16, 1 and 6 sum to 7, it doesn't sum to 4. So here's my statement. Prove there's an addition-safe number greater than 1. How would I go about this? What's the general form? Yeah? Yeah, this is an exists, right? There is means I'm in the there exists case. So I need to prove that there exists an x such that x is addition safe and, wrong one again. And x is greater than 1. Yeah?
How does the
4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4 is? 1 plus 6 is? Just keep adding digits until there's only one left. Okay? So, how do I prove an exists like this? I just pick my favorite one. I have 10 options. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 0, I guess. And I could just try them all. If we had time, we'd ask 10 of you to each try one of them and find out which one works. It turns out 9 will work, and you're welcome to try this out if you want. Anyway, this is what I have. There is an example quiz available that hopefully will help out some, and I may add some more practice to it later. I will see you all on Friday.